Okay, so this is the second lecture about F-theory. And I just kind of want to remind you what we did before. So we had elliptic vibrations. And an elliptic vibration could be written in this form, where, so this was an elliptic vibration over some base B, and F was a global section of some line bundle, and G was a global section of, to the sixth power, G was a global section of the same line bundle, F to the fourth, G to the sixth, and with that convention, X is supposed to be a section of the line bundle to the squared, I guess, and y to the section of the line bundle cubed. So there's some line bundle over B which governs the structure of this Weierstrass equation. And then there was, I'll put it back over here. So there was the sort of Kodaira, I guess today I'm calling it the Kodaira Tate table. Because I'm worried about the monodromy question as well as just the question of singular fibers. So I have I, N, and at least 1, 2, 3, 4, I0 star, I, N star, and at least 1, 4 star, 3 star, 2 star. It's mainly the Kodaira table, but I'll say one modification. So the singular fibers in this vibration are governed by the behavior of F, G, and the key quantity delta, which is 4F cubed plus 27G squared. And if you want to know what kind of singular fiber you have along a divisor, then you ask what the order of vanishing of F, G, and delta are along that divisor. And then there's another quantity to calculate that's known as beta. And I'll say what that beta is in a second. So the order of F is, So I'm leaving out non-singular fibers, and I'm leaving out multiple fibers. I kind of explained those points last time. So here, F and G don't vanish, but delta vanishes to order n. Here, this is why you write it down, so you don't get lost in recomputing it. So these are 2, 3, and 4, and those are 1, 1, and 2. So that's 2, and that's 2. And then this is exactly 6, and those are at least 2 and at least 3. And then here they're exactly 2 and 3 and n plus 6. And now we get to 8, which is 4 and at least 3. We have 9, which is exactly 3 and at least 5. We have 10, which is exactly 5 and at least 4. And then we have this non-minimal line, which I spent some time explaining last time, where the orders are greater than or equal to 4, 6, and 12. Okay, so that tells me exactly what kind of fiber I'm seeing over the general point of the divisor that has this vanishing behavior. But there's one additional condition. So what I imagine is the delta equals zero can be written as a union of various components, sigma sub I. Actually, it's a divisor. So as a divisor, it's a sum of various components, sigma sub I. I guess you shouldn't really sum things whose name is sigma. It's a sum of things whose components are called sigma sub I with some multiplicities, m sub I indicating the multiplicity. So the order of delta there that we're just talking about along sigma I is m I. And then we're asking whether F and G also vanish along those loci. To say what beta is, I have to introduce a local equation for sigma I. So I'll call that S sub I locally. And then there's a quantity which you're supposed to calculate, which depends on the type. And that quantity is, in the IN case, it's G over F, restricted to sigma I. So these are all restricted to sigma I. Maybe I'll just say G. Maybe I'll just say G over F. In the type 2 case, it's 1. In the type 3 case, it's 1. In the type 4 case, it's G over SI squared. This makes sense, right? G is supposed to have vanishing of order 2, so G over SI squared will at least, it's locally well-defined, and it will be non-vanishing somewhere along the divisor, typically. Then here, this one is special. It's not exactly beta that you define. I n star. So this is trickier. You have to take the quantity delta, and then you have to divide it by the quantity G over F SI raised to the third power or fourth power, where 3 or 4 is congruent to, third power or second power, where 3 or 2 is congruent to n mod 2. So that's a pretty weird way of writing it. I should have split it into two parts, but the basic quantity is I had to take G over FSI and then divide delta by some power of that guy. And 4 star is G over S to the fourth, SI to the fourth, and then these are 1. And here it's not something I'm discussing. Okay, so what is this beta? So the remaining question about the structure along a divisor is, does beta restricted to sigma I have a square root or not? And it turns out that there's a local, or rather, there's an equation for the singular locus on the fiber over sigma I of the form y squared equals beta. That's all restricted to sigma I. Y squared minus beta restricted to sigma I equals 0. So if the picture here was I had the base, the elliptic curves were becoming singular along a certain curve sigma I, then over that curve sigma I you actually had a codimension 2 set in the total space, which was the set of singular fibers, and the equation for the singular locus has some I don't exactly mean the equation for the singular locus. I mean the equation for some component of the resolution. That's what I'm trying to say. Of the resolution of singularities has an equation like that. So working out that these are the right expressions for the various kinds of Kodaira fibers is essentially what Tate did in Tate's algorithm, his Tate algorithm paper, although it's not quite expressed that way. And it's certainly not expressed this way. I mean, this is a complicated way of saying what's going on. But it's not hard to see that these quantities make sense near the singular fiber. So you can calculate that delta really does have a third power or a second power of G over FSI when 3 or 2 is congruent to n mod 2, and that the these I already discussed, and here the guys are non-vanishing, so generically non-vanishing, so the ratio makes sense as a generic function. So this question is a sort of global question on the base about whether that guy has a square root, and it helps to answer a question about the monodromy of the type of fibers. So So the way this shows up is, so I've got my total space X over B, which maybe I'm going to call X bar over B. So maybe X bar is the total space set where Y squared equals X cubed plus FX plus G. And then, yes?
Is beta a section of like L?
So I can tell you what beta is a section of. So G is a section, so beta, you know, beta itself doesn't completely make sense, but beta restricted to sigma I makes sense. Beta restricted to sigma I is a section of, G's are a section of L cubed, and F is a section of L squared, so it's a section of L restricted to sigma I. And this guy is, you have to say L sigma I of minus 2 sigma I, right? Because you've got to take two powers of this away. And you can make, I don't have them written down in front of me, but you can do that for each of these guys. So X over B has this resolution of singularities, X tilde over B. And X bar over B has a resolution of singularities, X over B. X bar has these nice singularities called rational double points along the generic points of the sigma I's. But those rational double points, so the corresponding rational double point is A n minus 1. Well, here it's actually non-singular, A1, A2, D4, Dn plus 4, E6, E7, and E8. Those are the kinds of rational double points. And, the point is that these graphs might have monodromy. So the An graphs, for example, so now I'm potentially fibering these over some sigma in the base. And as I go around loops in sigma, I might swap the ends of this guy. So there's a monodromy on the ans, which swaps the ends. And whether that exists, whether the individual components are well-defined or whether they're only defined two at a time because of monodromy is determined by whether beta has a square root. So the reason the D4 is special is that there the monodromy is order 3, so the D4 graph has this structure, and you have a potential S3 monodromy. And so the question that's being asked is whether there's 0, 1, or 3 roots which are defined single-valuedly over the base, right? And those are the three possibilities, and I don't have as easy a criterion for saying something or other has a square root to determine. It's something about the irreducibility of some cubic polynomial. If there's at least one root, well, never mind. If there's at least one root, then I can make it sort of a special case of this story where I use an L instead of, or maybe it's L squared, it's L of minus sigma instead of this guy. Sorry, this is 2 and this is 4. Yeah, over each sigma, I've got a rational double point of a particular kind, and what could be happening over that sigma is that as I wander around in sigma, I could lose track of the ends of the graph. So whether or not I can separately define these two end curves and the adjacent curves and the adjacent curves, and we get down to this one, whether or not we can define the two points of intersection, that becomes, when you write algebraically the resolution of singularities, that becomes a question of whether this guy splits into two components or just one. Right? And so you write down the beta, which gives you that information, and those are the betas that show up. So what I said in the abstract was that, okay, so that was a rational double point, and then there was the group, which I think I wrote down last time. So this is the information that you need to get the group. Here it's SUN. Here there was nothing, SU2. Well, it depends on whether there's monodromy or not. So it's SUN or SP, greatest integer in n over 2. And here you might have SU3 or SP1. The D4 could be G2, well, it could be SO8, SO7, or G2, depending on whether you had 3, 1, or 0 roots defined over the component sigma. Here is SO, I can never do this, 2n, n is 0, 2n plus 8, or SO 2n plus 7. And here is E6 or F4, and here is E7 or E8. So all of the possible simple groups show up. A few of them are showing up more than once in this list as things that can be realized through this F-theory construction. Okay, so actually this monodromy stuff starts showing up in F-theory once you get down to what in physics would be called F-theory in dimension 7. From algebraic geometry, it looks a little funny because you want the base then to be a 3-manifold. So the 3-manifolds that you take are basically circle bundles over Riemann surfaces. But once you've got that circle bundle there, there's an issue about whether these monodromies were realized as you went around the circle. So the monodromy starts showing up right away, even when you just do circle bundles over the original elliptic vibrations. And then once you get down to physical theories of dimension 6, which means elliptic threefolds or fourfolds or higher, then there's an additional piece of data that one wants for the physical theory to read off of the structure of the elliptic vibration, and that's the so-called matter representation of the physical theory. So I got a group. I actually didn't tell you how to globally get the group, but I at least got a local group. I got all of the factors that I wanted for the group out of this sort of story. And so G is the associated group. And now we actually want to have a particular representation of G. So can think of that as a homomorphism from G to some GLN. And typically that's a reducible representation. So it's a product of various GL, product from, say, I equal 1 to K, of various GLN sub I's. And so I get representations of this group, finite dimensional irreducible representations of this group. And the basic idea is that any fiber on a point sigma I, which is worse than generic, contributes an irreducible representation to this matter representation. Usually. So I'll make it precise in a couple of minutes. And moreover, the genus of the singular locus of, let's see, I don't really want to say genus because I don't want to. I guess what I want to say is H10 of sigma I or H10 of sigma I tilde also contributes. Some irrep. What's sigma I tilde? So if there is monodromy over a component sigma I, then there's a natural monodromy cover sigma I tilde over sigma I in this situation, right? Almost always that's a double cover, and it's the double cover which is described by, with branch locus, the zeros of this guy beta. Except in the I0 star case where it might be a triple cover instead of a double cover for the monotrope. But it's almost always a double cover. Okay, so this looks a little strange, but there's this amazing formula which sort of ties everything together, which I hope to get to today. Please, yes.
Too late. But this is because the D7 is sourcing D3 brain charge or something else? Is it someplace where like D7's intersection?
Right, so it's intersections, that's right. So the example for physicists or one example for physicists goes like this. So the SUN, which corresponded to Kodaira's type I sub N, corresponds in physics language to a stack of ND7 brains. And now, one thing which is a familiar construction in physics is to have transverse stacks of brains. So I have ND7 brains here and MD7 brains here. And the interpretation in F-theory language is that I've got one component here, one component here. The order of vanishing of the discriminant on this one is n. The order of vanishing on the discriminant of this one is m. And then they can meet in some point, and that point is going to be associated to the representation, the so-called bifundamental representation of SUN cross SUM. Namely, it's a representation of dimension n times m on which SUN acts by multiplication on the left and SUM acts by multiplication on the right. So it looks like n by m matrices, essentially, being acted upon by those two groups. So that's a sort of typical example. So the mathematical task is to assign this representation, but then you have to tell me what property, as a mathematician, you have to tell me what properties it's supposed to have. And there are several different arguments that have been used in the physics literature to justify certain assignments. It's not obvious a priori that those arguments would lead to the same assignment of matter representation to various singular points on the fibers of, various places where the fiber becomes worse on the singularity, but they do all agree, and that's kind of a remarkable fact. So let me mention two methods which have been discussed for determining the representation. The first method is the Katz-Waffa method. And it says that at points of sigma prime, or I should say, so let's try to do it in complete generality. So I've got some base manifold B. It's containing sigma I, which is codimension 1 on B. And then we want to be at some points gamma alpha, which are codimension 2 on B. If B happens to be a surface, then the gamma alphas will be points. But if B is dimension 3, which is the interest for F-theory compactifications to four dimensions, then the gammas will actually be curves. And there's one other phenomenon beyond the representation which has to be accounted for. And that's the so-called Yukawa couplings in the physical theory. We have to do something in codimension 3. If we're basically working with B a surface, then the codimension 2 is all we have to worry about. But this method of assigning a representation, a matter representation, is supposed to work for, well, I should enumerate all of the codimension 2 varieties on which the sigma I got worse singularities, and I should assign a matter representation to each of those. So in the Katz-Vapa method, the idea is that we exclude places where the non-minimal line on the Kadaira table is reached even in codimension 2. So what do I mean by that? Well, the Kadaira table was really a table describing what happened with orders of vanishing of F, G, and delta along divisors. However, if you're in codimension 2, you can ask what the multiplicity of F, G, or delta at that codimension 2 point is, and you could make a similar, you could ask similar questions about the multiplicity. When you get to this, to one of these non-minimal points, not on a divisor but in codimension 2, it turns out you can blow up that codimension 2 locus and improve the situation, improve from non-minimal to something maybe approaching minimal, and after a finite number of blow-ups of that type, you can always achieve something minimal. And so it turns out that the physical interpretation of the non-minimal guys is sort of complicated. It's not a purely field-theoretic interpretation. And so the usual strategy has been to do those blow-ups and to just study the ones without any non-minimal line in the Kadaira table. So if we exclude those places, and the exclusion is kind of for physical reasons, then the fibers over one of these gammas are still of ADE type. There's some kind of ADE fiber over gamma, and we actually have an ADE degeneration . So now I'm talking about, when I say they're still of ADE type, i.e., the total space is locally kind of an ADE type. So the picture is that I've got my base. On the base, I've got a component sigma, and then sitting in sigma, I've got gamma. Over sigma, I've got the locus of singular points of pi inverse of, singular points of x, which are of some kind of ADE type. And then over gamma, I have a worse type. So here the type is constant over sigma, and then I have some worse type over gamma. In particular, that means that if I take this ADE type, so if I try to classify the gamma by its ADE type, then I need to find a deformation of that type of ADE singularity to a slightly less bad singularity, so that deforms to the sigma type. And the deformation theory of ADE singularities is known and is nicely connected to the group theory. So if gamma has some type, let me call it type R for the name of the root system, then there's a local deformation space which looks like C to the rank of R mod the Weyl group of R. And there's a versal family of surfaces which has the ADE singularity of type R right there, and then depends on these parameters and gives you the complete deformation of surfaces. Moreover, there's a discriminant locus. So the discriminant locus for this problem, delta R, sitting in C rank R mod the Weyl group of R. And that discriminant locus can be described in a pretty explicit way. So I take my C rank R, and in here I take the union of all of the rho perp, where rho is a positive root in the root system R. Okay, I'm kind of assuming people know about roots theory. So these ADE singularities are associated to a Dinkin diagram. There's a root system associated to that Dinkin diagram. All these roots are in the Lie algebra signature, the classes of self-intersection 2 in that lattice, and they divide into positive and negative. Actually, I can just say root. They divide into positive and negative types, but each of their orthogonal complements will define a hyperplane in the vector space spanned by the root system. So I take the union of those hyperplanes, and then I mod out by the file group of the root system, and I exactly get the discriminant, which is the union of all those hyperplanes modded out by the file group. Okay, so that was very maybe too abstract, so let me explain how it works for R equals AN minus 1. So for R equals AN minus 1, the singularity is XY equals Z to the N. So that's the singularity. The deformations of that singularity look like XY equals Z to the N plus A2Z to the N minus 2 plus A3Z to the N minus 3. Down to AN. Higher order terms can be absorbed into Z to the N by a change of variables. The N minus 1 term you don't need because you can make the standard so-called Chernhausen transformation, the generalization of completing the square, to get rid of that Z to the N minus 1 term. So this is a good deformation for the entire space. And these quantities A2 up through AN are the elementary symmetric functions of some other guys, R1 up to Rn, subject to the sum of the Ri's, sum of the Rj's is equal to 0. Right? In fact, a way to see that is to write this degree n polynomial in factored form, z minus Rj. And if I write it in factored form, my statement is obvious. The sum of these guys is normally what would go in as A1 here. This is true up to sine. So the sum of the guys is what would normally go here as A1, and then the rest of them, I guess if I really wanted it to be true without the sine, I would have put a plus there. Okay, so I've got my Cn minus 1, and my Cn minus 1, that's the set of R1 to Rn such that R1 plus Rn equals 0. And it contains the sets where Ri equals Rj. Those are the perpendiculars of the roots. And the of course, where is this guy singular? Well, this guy has singularities exactly along the discriminant of this thing. So the discriminant of z to the n plus a2z to the n minus 2 down to an is exactly the image of the union of all the sets ri equals rj in cn minus 1 mod the symmetric group. And the symmetric group is the Weyl group. So anyway, this is the story about deformations of these singularities. It turns out that the other ones, the D's and the E's, have the same pattern. There's a deformation of the singularities. That parameter space is, in a natural way, identified with the quotient by the Weyl group of the complexified root space, maybe it's co-root space, and in there you've got a bunch of hyperplanes, and the image of those hyperplanes is this discriminant locus, which, by the way, is an irreducible polynomial with bad singularities by the time you get down to here, but it has this nice structure of hyperplanes when you're up there. I'm going to, well, not yet, but next time through, I'll erase part of that because I feel like I'm running out of board space.
So C is minus 1 you're viewing as the total deformation space of the single layer?
That's correct.
And
I identify it with the root space of the an minus 1 singularity tensor with C. And I think of that as being spanned by these R's, which are acted upon by the symmetric group. That's the Weyl group. And the places where the guy is singular are places where two R's coincide. That's a bunch of hyperplanes in this space. But then when you take the quotient, it becomes the zeros of this one polynomial, which is the discriminant that you can calculate out of these A's. Right? It's an irreducible polynomial with a kind of nasty singularity at the origin, which is what remains of that nice union of hyperplanes that were invariant under the symmetric group. So for an, it's all nice and explicit. You can see what's going on. For dn, you can also do it explicitly, but it's you have to work a lot harder. And then for the e's, you can be explicit if you want to, but the Weyl group of V6 is the symmetry group of the 27 lines on the cubic surface. So how explicit are you going to be able to be about things like this? So I was explaining the Katz-Waffa method. So the Katz-Waffa method is that I took my root system of a particular kind, and then I wanted a deformation, which was a smaller root system, but still typically singular. And so where is that? That deformation lives on the intersection of a certain finite number of these root hyperplane complements. So I don't just want an minus 1 going to become non-singular. I want it to become some less singular guy. And I understand what's going on by taking the intersection of these guys. And that gives me a playground in which I can sort of try to make computations. So I might have an an minus 1 here. And then nearby, I might have an A, an AK for some K less than N minus 1. And I can try to analyze what's going on. So here is what you're supposed to do to get the associated matter representation to this point under these circumstances. There's a group associated with each of these guys. So I've got the group associated with R, and I've got the group associated with R prime. And the containment of root systems, the way that I'm describing here, actually gives me a containment of groups. So I can decompose the adjoint representation of GR under GR prime. That's what you're instructed to do. And you find that you get a copy of the adjoint representation of GR prime plus some other residual guy. And the definition is you assign rho to gamma. Usually. So, again, I've got a caveat which I have to explain in a second. So, the simplest cases are when the rank drops by 1. So I can tell you what those are. So if I do a n minus 1 and have a rank drop, it goes to a n minus, excuse me, a n goes to a n minus 1. That's a rank drop. So here I have the group SUN. And the rho that I get in this case is what's usually called the fundamental representation of SUN. All that's saying is that if I have n plus 1 by n plus 1 matrices and I decompose according to n by n matrices and I have this extra column, also the extra row, I get the fundamental representation plus its complex conjugate. There are a couple of issues with reality conditions and exactly what I'm talking about here, which have to be done more carefully than I'm going to do it today. But essentially, I'm just getting the fundamental representation out of that. If I take dn to an minus 1, so that means sun compared with SO2n, and then the row turns out to be wedge 2 of the fundamental representation, the so-called antisymmetric or 2 antisymmetric representation of an minus 1. And then there are some special cases, en contained in an minus 1, which works for n equals 6, 7, and 8, and that's ends up producing wedge 3 of the fundamental representation, which only occurs in those cases. Or if I was starting with dn, then I might have had a dn plus 1. So that's SO2n contained in SO2n plus 2. For some reason. Okay, so there's. So that's actually. I could do that, but I'm not going to. I'm going to. Well. So that's SO2n. It's really contained in SO2n plus 1. I'll explain why I use the non-simply laced one in a few minutes. But that produces, as rho, the so-called vector representation of SO2n, the standard representation of SO2n. And then there are a few cases where en plus 1 contains dn, and then rho turns out to be some spinner representation. You have to be a little careful about which spinner you're talking about. And then for E, of course, I would have En contains En plus 1. And so for E6, I get the 27-dimensional representation. And for E7, I get the 56-dimensional representation. But that's a quaternionic representation, and each branch point is associated with a half of one of those. And again, that has to do with these reality conditions that I'm not being real careful about right now. So there's some meaning to that statement. Okay, so these are the representations that I get out of the basic construction that Katzenbacher proposed. And of course, you can get more, right? You can have a higher dimensional inclusion. So I didn't really include the cases of SUN cross SUN that I had mentioned before, but of course you could do that. You can sort of get two nearby singular fibers. So that would be a gamma, which is why I labeled them differently, at the intersection of a sigma I and a sigma j. Then you would have the gamma, which would be associated to two group factors. And of course, so we would need a longer list and do all this representation theory, but it's all pretty straightforward. I mean, this one and this one are kind of the hardest ones to do. Those you just look up in some table that tells you how EN decompositions, representations, the adjoint of EN decomposes under various subgroups. So that's all pretty straightforward for assigning a representation. The thing that I didn't tell you about was the branch points of the monodromy map. So if I have branch points, or well, let's see, there was a possibility that it wasn't branched, right? There was a possibility that that the divisor beta was actually had a square root. So in general, I should say zeros of beta. Then there's something a little unusual which happens. So it's quite unusual for the branch points and for zeros of beta. I'm still saying something funny about this case. I'm not sure what I'm saying about this case. Well, it is if it's yes, that's a 2n plus 2. So I seem to get two vectors. It's true, I get two vectors. But then because it's a zero of beta, I'm going to count it for 1/2. So I'm not telling you the rules in a systematic way at the moment. I'm basically telling you how to get the representations, but I'll give a different way of setting it up in a few minutes.
Shouldn't it be like the vector plus vector bar?
It's real.
Twice the vector?
Something like that. Well, no, because... right? I've actually got both two vectors and two vector bars. Well, maybe not, though, because... Those are equal. I see. So I get the vector plus the vector bar. Yeah, the reality conditions and the complex conjugate business, I'm not saying too clearly. Yeah. So branch points at zeros of beta, an interesting thing... Before I say that, I should say that if there's no monodromy, and I already alluded to this, we also get... H10 copies, H10 sigma I copies of the adjoint representation of the ith group. So what's happening with branch points is kind of interesting. What's happening with branch points is I should compare, so what I have there is a group a larger group GI tilde and a smaller group GI, which can be thought of as GI tilde mod an appropriate Z2 involute, or rather the fixed points, the algebra GI tilde modulo, where the fixed points in some Z2 involution of that algebra is the algebra of GI. There's some story like that for each of these symplectic inside of SU and these other cases. So there's another kind of decomposition to do. Namely, you've got H10 of sigma I tilde and H10 of sigma I. And these are to be associated with the adjoint of the group. And these are to be associated with essentially the adjoint of the covering group minus the adjoint of the group. Right? The covering group, the minus one, the involution will act on the adjoint of the covering group, and you get as the invariance the adjoint of the group, and so this is the anti-invariant part. And so that in a way is a representation rho, which is sort of associated to branch points. But when you do the count of branch points, now I'm really in the case where sigma is a Riemann surface. If I do the count of branch points, the difference in genera is not exactly, well, it's half of the number of branch points or something like that. So I have to put a factor of 1/2 when I made that computation. So I've got two things going on. I've got this story where there's some cover going on of the curve, and then I've got the Kasvafa story. And the Kasvafa story can also be related to this cover going on of the curve, because one subtlety of this story that I didn't explain was what happens if the monodromy group of the simpler Dinkin diagram and the monodromy group, if the action of the monodromy group of the bigger diagram on the smaller one is different from the native action on the smaller one. So then there's some little issue with that, which is closely related to this point right here. Anyway, that's sort of one approach to writing down some sort of representation of a group. Completely unmotivated, I guess, from the point of view of mathematics. I mean, if you just were studying these elliptic vibrations, I don't know why you ever would have thought. You might have thought of associating groups, and you might have even thought of, you know, assigning the non-simply laced groups to the simply laced ones with monodromy. There's a beautiful mathematical theory due to Breeskorn and Grothendieck relating the group theory to the rational double point, and it was extended by Slotovy to non-simply laced groups and double points that had group actions on them. And so this connection is actually implicit already in the mathematics literature. But this next step of also assigning these funny representations of these groups to further degenerate points is something nobody really would have thought of, I don't think, before the F-theory application came along. Well, I'm going to explain another way of getting this matter representation out and how it's related to something in six-dimensional physics called anomaly cancellation that has to hold for the six-dimensional physical model, and it leads to an approach to understanding sort of geometric and topological aspects of these elliptically fibered three-dimensional varieties, which again I don't think people would have stumbled upon if they hadn't had this point of view to begin with. I don't know how far I'm going to get with that today, given the time. But since I've got a bunch of stuff on the board, let me at least outline it. So the outline goes like this. I'm going to define two or three basic representations for each group, or more precisely, each line on the Kadirah-Tate table. And they're going to come equipped with sort of geometric descriptions of their location. Now, this is not a complete list of all the representations that can occur, but one conjectures that all representations are built out of these as the geometric conditions that I'll describe coalesce in appropriate ways. So one of the representations is going to be associated with beta equals zero. One of the representations is, as we already know, associated with H10 of sigma I. Okay? So that's associated with the adjoint of the group GI. Second representation for sigma I is going to be associated with the locus where beta equals zero. And more precisely, it's going to be associated with half of the locus where beta equals zero. So that either makes sense as a line bundle in the case that the square root of beta existed, right? If the square root of beta exists, then all of the zeros are double zeros, and this makes sense as a divisor on sigma I. If the square root doesn't exist, then half of that locus beta equals zero actually makes sense as a divisor upstairs on sigma I tilde, and we actually get into this business of the difference between the adjoint of the covering group and the adjoint of the group. So that's going to be associated to a particular representation that I'll call rho beta, and it's really associated with half in each case. And in the case of monodromy, rho beta is a virtual representation which looks like add gi tilde mod add gi. So it's virtual. There are little lemmas that you prove that the resulting representation that you get doesn't actually have any subtractions. So anyway, we'll see that in a second. And then another one where some divisor called alpha equals zero, and that's associated to a row alpha, and so I should tell you about alpha. And the way I'm going to tell you about alpha is by looking on my table. So alpha is delta, right? So I have to divide delta by the appropriate power of S, and then I can divide this by beta squared in the IN case. Here alpha is just F over SI. Sorry, here there's no alpha. Here alpha is F over SI. Right, head order 1. Here there's no alpha. This is a special case. Here alpha is my G over FSI. Here it's 1. Here it's F over SI cubed. And here it's G over SI to the 5th. And here I don't define it. Okay, so I get another natural divisor out of there, and I'm going to associate a representation rho alpha to that guy. So to fully tell you everything, I should tell you what all these rho alpha and rho beta representations are, and maybe another table I would use to do that. I won't try to do that today. Yeah.
In your conjecture, do you really mean all representations of any group?
I mean all representations that occur in F-theory models.
Okay.
So the geometric conditions are, you know, you look for, so beta and alpha are divisors on the sigma i's. I haven't been so careful about how to discuss intersections of sigma i's and sigma j's in this business. So those are actually multiple zeros of alphas and betas. You have to be somewhat careful about that. But if I just sort of ignore that phenomenon for a moment, the half of this divisor or this divisor tells me particular representations to associate. And now there's this remarkable thing, which again comes from the physics, which is that when the physical theory, so this is the case dim B equals 2, and it says that if we avoid this non-minimal line in the Kodaira table, even in codimension 2, which gives us a supposed field theory description of the resulting theory, then there must be a formula of the following kind. So the formula looks like, let me get the normalization right. There must be a formula of the following kind. So okay, so I have to tell you where this formula lives. So this formula lives in the Picard group of B. Well, I'm going to do intersection, so it's not quite there. It's the cycle, it's the algebraic cycle on B, tensored with the space of differential forms on an 8 manifold. On R8, I can even say. Doesn't really matter what 8 manifold it is. So that's where this formula is going to live. And the formula is going to have some ingredients. So there's going to be a particular differential form which is supposed to be coming from the curvature of the six-dimensional theory, a various forms that involve the gauge group that we have, and then in principle, other ones that involve fourth powers of the curvature, both from the metric and from the gauge group, I think I'm going to manage to explain this in a way, because I'm doing it fast, that will be clear neither to mathematicians nor physicists. That would be quite an accomplishment. Let's see if I can not do that. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, let me finish the formula, then we'll find out if it makes sense to anybody. So I sum over sigma I times the trace of Fi squared, and I'm going to take the square of that. So taking the square of that means that I'm doing intersection theory on B to calculate things like KB squared, and then I'm also tensoring together these funny objects, trace R squared and trace Fi squared, and then some cross terms, trace R squared times trace Fi squared. And that's supposed to be equal to, so this is a prediction from the physical theory, that's supposed to be equal to, well, first of all, a number that turns out to act to definitely be KB squared over 8 trace R squared squared, plus some other terms, 1/6 trace R squared times a sum, cleverly getting right down to someone, times the sum of the trace in the adjoint of Fi squared minus sum over the representations, the multiplicity of the representation, the trace in the representation of Fi squared. Minus 2/3 times the sum of a similar guy with fourth powers, trace and adjoint Fi to the fourth, minus the sum over rho and rho, trace and rho, Fi to the fourth, plus 4 times some cross terms, sum of I less than j, n rho sigma, trace in rho of Fi squared, trace in sigma of Fj squared, plus a term whose coefficient I've forgotten, trace R to the fourth. I agree that it's not a pretty formula. So what does it actually boil down to? It boils down to, first of all, to evaluate expressions like the trace of the adjoint. These traces were done in basically a particular representation, the fundamental representation. To evaluate all of these traces in terms of that fundamental trace, you have to do some group theory work. So there's some group theory work figuring out what all these traces are. Then this will give proposed inequalities. Well, the first one is clear from the way I've written things down. The R squared squared term is okay. The mixed terms are making a statement about those group theoretic factors there being equal to these particular factors, and then the cross terms have a similar nature, and then that trace R to the fourth term in the anomaly says that coefficient actually has to vanish. You know, I would write it as with 29s and things, but there may even be an overall factor of that in this normalization, which I've forgotten at the moment.
Wait, sorry, so that big circle is zero, or it's something?
It's something which has to be set to zero. So that, so Vijay, what is it?
It's summation n rho dim rho. It's h minus v plus 29t.
Thank you. That's what I'm wanting.
It's the physics that tells you that's the finish, not anything in
physics says that this that side has to equal this side.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So So what does that say mathematically? It says various complicated things about my choice of representation. And I'm about to explain why all of those are natural consequences of this way to set up the representation. And then it implies a separate thing, which boils down to a formula for the order characteristic of an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau threefold, which wasn't known, I mean, which is sort of independent of mathematical knowledge about what those should be. So that's a sort of separate prediction.
So the Fi live over the sigma I?
The Fi are, the Fi's are the curvatures of a connection on GI, right? So this statement is a statement about the physical theory. But really, you know, we can ignore the algebra of differential forms except for the group theoretic part of the computation and just treat this as a bunch of facts about intersection theory on B which have to be true, but whose coefficients are going to be determined by a group theory calculation. And what I'm doing here is essentially to this divisor I'm associating a certain group, to this representation, to this divisor I'm associating a certain representation, and in a second I'll tell you why that formula is true in some easy to state way.
So, but doesn't that mean I'm not only associating a group but a whole bundle with the structure?
A group and a representation. I mean, this is the connection in this eight-dimensional space. Well, it's a connection on a six-dimensional space, but it's an auxiliary. These anomaly computations are always done two dimensions above where you are.
E3 tadpoles?
Pardon?
Is that E3 tadpoles or what is it?
No, this is Green-Schwarz cancellation for the associated six-dimensional theory.
Okay.
So this square term is. Slightly fancy way of saying what term you need to put in as the Green-Schwarz term in the theory. No, I completely agree that it sounds like the order characteristic should be related, but yeah, I don't know how to make that relation. Okay, well, I'm going to quit soon. Oh, I just erased my formula. And I erased my table over there. But anyway, each of these guys, half beta equals zero, or alpha equals zero, or how do I compute the genus? I essentially compute that by taking k sigma plus sigma and restricting that to sigma, right? That'll give me 2g minus 2. Or a half of that will give me g minus 1. So each of the representations that I just discussed has an associated divisor on sigma I. So I've got rho beta times some rho beta times some. Wow, the notation is sort of bad because there has to be an I here as well. Plus the adjoint times this one half, and here I had one half also, k sigma I plus sigma I restricted to sigma I. So I have sort of a formal sum of representations with coefficients in this Chow group of B associated to the geometric data. And the real claim is that when you take that formal sum of representations and do the group theory calculations with that formal sum, you get this formula on the nose. On the other hand, the definitions of these divisors are all case by case, but the group theory formulas that you need to reduce are also case by case, and everything matches beautifully, but I need a pair of tables, each with 12 lines to compare with you side by side to convince you of how nice it is. So maybe next week I'll try to pick out a couple special cases of that to convince you of how nice it's going to be. So there's a way of assigning representations to this story which fits extremely nicely into this framework of, you know, all the anomaly cancellation says is that somehow the degrees on both sides are the same. Here I should have put something like degree, right? Because I don't just take the intersections of the as cycles, I take the degree. But what's really true is that in the Chow group, here, wherever I saw a representation, I could have also put this this codimension 2 guy, and I would have had a formula that agreed with the codimension 2 guys. I'm going to stop there for today. I've tangled myself up well enough.
So is this an equation really in the coefficients for the forms take value in?
Well, the reason I said that nobody would understand it is that I wrote a version of the equation which generalizes the physical version and generalizes the mathematical version simultaneously. So the physics equation wouldn't have these algebraic cycles in there. It would just be an equality of degrees of cycles or something like that. The mathematical version wouldn't try to manipulate these differential forms on R8 because we don't know what that means. So that it would be some set of equations which came from this, and the physics version would be some set of equations which came from this, but this is the ultimate equation taking values in the Chow group tensored with the space of differential forms on an auxiliary 8 manifold for the 6-dimensional theory.
So this R is derived from what geometry?
On the 8 manifold, or on the 6 manifold, rather. That's the gravity theory on the 6 manifold. I have a gauge theory on the 6 manifold. I take those differential forms, but I lift them to the 8 manifold in this descent process. And you can do algebra of the differential forms on that 8 manifold, that sort of formal 8 manifold. I'm just going to stop talking. I guess it's really differential forms taking values in some appropriate G bundle over that 8 manifold. That's really what I should be saying.
But, you told us how to get from the singularities to associate the groups to it.
Right.
How do we get the information to associate connections to it?
The connection doesn't matter. I mean, for any connection, there's a curvature operator, and this is just this is like a computation you would make in the configuration space for the physical theory.
Oh, okay.
So for any connection, you can make this computation. But then this needs to be a universal formula that holds whatever the connection is.
And that holds on the level of forms.
On the level of forms. But it's really a sum of objects that are kind of well-defined, which are the curvatures in these basic representations of this group. And so it's the coefficients of those which have to be checked. And my interpretation of the coefficients puts them in this Chow group of the base.
So if I would know how to expand the left-hand side, the surprising thing wouldn't be really the terms I get, but the coefficients of the terms.
The coefficients of the trace terms, right? They have to equal coefficients of trace terms on the other side, and that's a whole bunch of restrictions. The fact that it works is a little computation manipulating this expression for each of the groups involved, and it still sort of amazes me that each of the groups you have to do a slightly different thing to define these alphas and betas, but nevertheless that exactly matches with how the trace F squared and trace F to the fourth guys are related to the fundamental one for that group, so that everything sort of works out to a common formula.
And then it works out for every connection and every geometry I could pick.
That's just because I can essentially treat these four guys as independent variables. Right.
And then I have one other question. This divisor, alpha equal to zero, what is the interpretation?
So what I neglected to tell you was the delta over Si to the n looked like, restricted to sigma I, looked like alpha to some power restricted to sigma I times beta to some power restricted to sigma I, where the powers depend on which group type I have. So this one was defined by the branch locus. This is sort of the rest of the stuff, and sometimes it also is occurring with a power.
Okay.
So all this, so these are components of the intersection of the rest of the discriminant with the component, the sigma I that I'm on.
From the physics, the point was that you do an anomaly computation, you get the right-hand side, and you need to be able to rewrite it with the left-hand side to cancel it.
That's correct. That's correct. So you know, you've got to be able to put it in some form like this, and Sanyati sort of made this computation a long time ago and proposed some kind of generalized Green-Schwarz mechanism for doing the cancellations, and then Sadoff, in the early days of F-theory, wrote down some form essentially equivalent to this as the way you should do it for F-theory models. And there have been lots of special cases where it was worked out, but there, you know, we haven't had as general a form of this formalism as the one I've mentioned until recently.
So the right-hand side should be something like an index of an...
yeah, that's right.
And what would be the interpretation of the left-hand side?
Well, the left-hand side is the thing before you square it is a term that has to be added to the Lagrangian to make sure that the index vanishes. Okay. So you write down a pure supergravity gauge theory, and it's anomalous in most cases. But then in 10 dimensions, we first learned that there's this nifty Green-Schwarz mechanism, which string theory implies, that explains some other kinds of terms that you should put in the Lagrangian to cancel that anomaly. This is the six-dimensional version of that.
And so there should be a natural geometric interpretation to that?
To this term, it's a geometric object taking values in Chow, tensor, differential forms on R8, and I don't know what that means. And not just differential forms, but tensor with some connection on some bundle, right? That's as you point out, right?
And you can see these terms from the supergravity action, from the transcendental part of the supergravity action.
Right.
So they reduce to the anomaly canceling. The anomaly canceling terms in 10D would reduce to anomaly canceling terms in 6D in some cases.
So in that way they are natural.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Okay, I've lost everybody. Maybe not quite everybody. Hopefully I've lost different people in different places. So